Welcome to the Closed-Minded Podcast, where we read with an open mind in order to close it again on something solid. Today, I'm speaking with Dr. Gordon Wilson, professor of biology at New St. Andrews College in Moscow, Idaho. Dr. Wilson has written a new book about how Christians should engage with creation care and environmentalism. Dr. Wilson has written a new book, A Different Shade of Green, about how Christians should engage with creation care and environmentalism. He's also the narrator and chief explorer in the fantastic nature documentary, The Riot and the Dance. That film is currently streaming on Amazon Prime, and I highly recommend that you go check it out. It was shot and directed by his nephew, N.D. Wilson, who also happens to be one of my favorite authors. So this is a fun conversation about creation, environmentalism, the politics of both, and how Christians should think about all these things. Dr. Gordon Wilson, welcome to the Closed-Minded Podcast.
Hi, Seth. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, I really appreciate your book, A Different Shade of Green, A Biblical Approach to Environmentalism and the Dominion Mandate. There's a lot of quotable content in here, and I'm looking forward to talking with you about it. But before we get into the book, if you could maybe just give us a little bit of background on you, how you got into biology and science in general, what your career has looked like, what you're doing now. Just give me a little bit of a background.
Yeah. When I was really young, I think innately interested in life. When I first saw life when I was growing up in Annapolis, whether it was a crab from the Chesapeake or a box turtle from the woods across the street, I was just enthralled with it. I didn't know the word biology, but I knew that I was just fascinated with life. And it's just the way God sort of programs us. I liked things to build with, but it had to be organic. So I was more drawn to wooden tinker toys or Lincoln logs than erector sets. Anything that was inorganic material, I wasn't interested in. I liked anything that was biology, living or from living materials. And I had a dinosaur phase, as many young kids do. They put plastic dinosaurs in cereal boxes that we fished out of the box. Even before you got to the bottom, you grabbed the dinosaur out of it. So I had a dinosaur phase, and I just went through different things. In junior high, like sharks, that was sort of a shark phase. But I'd say riding through all of that was this love of reptiles and amphibians. That's sort of the mainstay, although I like anything that's green or wiggles. I teach, so that interest led me into biology, and in high school I realized that more and more, even in high school, I started to realize that I needed to teach anything that I learned. And so I could either annoy my mom and dad or my sister with things that they didn't really want to hear, or I could get paid to do this rather than annoy people. So I went into education. So now I teach at New St. Andrews College in Moscow, Idaho, and teach a variety of different biology classes there. And I love it. Anything that can that I get to explain the glories of God to my students, acknowledge God, that's the one thing that I'm so grateful for. Compared to teaching at a secular institution where you teach about all of this amazing stuff, but then you are prohibited from giving glory to God, who is responsible for it all, who created it all. And so I just love teaching from a Christian perspective. And I've always been interested as a Christian and as a biologist. I've been very interested in the creation evolution controversy, but also paralleling that, I've been interested in just the whole idea of conservation. And so that's what led me to writing this book.
Yeah. So tell me if this is incorrect, but the way that maybe I would summarize this book overall, or the purpose of it, is to sort of set the stage for Christians to understand why they should care about
creation and the environment and conservation and, mm-hmm. You know, even the ugly and the dangerous creatures,
right.
instead of not be worried about, I guess,
not worried about being associated with environmentalists, because is that what you were getting at? The fear of being associated with any kind of liberal left green agenda?
Yes.
Okay. I talk about this in the book. There's two ways of going. A lot of people either want to react against the whole environmental movement because of all of its craziness and worship of nature, elevating the value of nature on par or equal to man. Man is just an animal. And so you've got all of these pantheistic notions mixed into it. And so we react against that, and we should, but that can also result in us throwing the baby out with the bathwater and not seeing, we somehow think the environment is in the realm of, is the realm of the environmentalist rather than the creation. We need to relabel it as the creation, not the environment, because once we realize this is God's creation, this is not the sphere of eco zealots, that it's not their responsibility. He gave it to us to tend and care for, and so we need to sort out the nonsense and look at our Bibles afresh, not react against them, but not be duped by them. Too many Christians will either take the real radical redneck approach that just repudiates anything they hold dear, or they get sucked into the green agenda, and then they just try to Christianize it, sprinkle a little Jesus on it, sprinkle a little gospel on it, and but then drink the Kool-Aid of the whole environmentalist agenda. And that's just wrong. It's just very wrong. So we need to think biblically about it, all of it. And that's why I wanted to write the book, is just not so much get into, I mean, I do deal with issues, but I wanted to mostly lay down biblical principles. Because if you get so stuck into every little environmental problem, you just start to get overwhelmed with the details and data. And I didn't want to get into that. I wanted to get down to the biblical principles and then use our heads to apply those biblical principles in whatever arena of life God has put you, whether it's taking care of your dog or cat or snake, or you're in charge of a garden, I mean, or a state park, or, you know, a big piece of land. How should we look at that as a gift of God? How should we look at diversity that God has made from a biblical perspective?
Yeah. So I think that, you know, what you just said is you're probably not going to find any Christians that at that level are going to disagree with what you just described.
Right.
So let's get into some of the specific Christian stereotypes that you identify early on in the book for the different ways that Christians sort of veer off from the biblical approach to engaging these topics. So we've got I'll give the names real quick, and then if you want to just go through them, that would be great. We've got anti-green Andy. We've got pre-mill Pete, we've got apathetic April, and then green Greta. So tell me about those.
In a nutshell, anti-green Andy is someone who wants to take up the antithesis. They see all of the wrong-headed views, heavy-handed environmental regulations, and environmental philosophies, and they just repudiate all of it. As a result, they throw the baby out with the bathwater. Rather than looking at the creation as something God has given us to tend and manage and to take care of, they just see it as, well, that's the realm of those wacko environmentalists. And so if they want to save it, you know, I'll be very leery of anything that they want to do, and I'll usually posture myself against that. That's sort of the anti Green Andy approach. The apathetic April, as the name implies, is that person doesn't really think about it much. They just think, oh, I do my job, I go to work, I Facebook, I go to church, and they just don't think about it. They don't have really any opinions about it, and they may tip their hat in some, you know, what's creation care? Well, recycle? I don't know. They just don't put any thought into it. Pre-mill Pete is basically saying it's all going to burn, so we shouldn't spend too much time worrying about the creation that God has given us, because it's all going to melt with fervent heat, and we should be more about saving the lost. And it's sort of an almost a Gnostic approach. So God's only concerned about our spiritual state and not redeeming the creation as a whole. I mean, yes, people need to be redeemed, but so does creation. All creation groans. And he, you know, one of the first commandments was to have dominion over all of wildlife. That is a dominion mandate. It's sort of global wildlife management. And we can't just ignore that.
So what about Green Greta is the last one. And I thought that the timing of that was pretty apropos, even though you probably didn't intend it with when this was written, but it aligns well with our Scandinavian friend up at the UN.
I know. It's sort of ironic, but I didn't know of her until after I wrote this little stereotype. But, you know, these stereotypes are supposed to be various flavors of Christians, and Greta Green is sort of the opposite of Green Greta is the opposite of Andy Green Andy. She just is really adopted as gospel truth all of the environmental agenda. Of course, she thinks that CO2 is an evil gas and we need to reduce our carbon footprint. We need to take lukewarm showers. We need to have an electric or hybrid car, and we need to atone for all of our environmental sins somehow by having fewer kids. And so they've just sort of drunk the Kool-Aid of whatever the environmental agenda has said is a problem. They've uncritically taken it on board and said, oh, they say it's a problem. We need to get on their bandwagon. And rather than look at it from a Christian perspective, they just say, oh, this is a problem. Now we're going to follow suit.
I think for myself, I'm probably a mix of, and this might not make any sense, but I'm a mix of anti-Green Andy and apathetic April in my worst moments. You know, to some extent, there are things happening in the world of, you know, conservation and environmentalism that I'm just not aware of. And so what I don't know, I don't care about and don't pay any attention to. So there's certainly an element there. But to the extent that I am aware of things in that world, I tend to be, you know, in the direction of reacting against the excesses of the crazy people. And I feel like I'm particularly sensitive to Malthusianism getting smuggled into stewardship discussions.
Yeah, I definitely don't think that population is a problem. And, you know, there may be limits in some unforeseeable future, but, you know, it is a finite planet, but that's not a problem right now. But it's so easy to just take up an adversarial relationship against all of the craziness. And I agree with my friends at church who are really opposed to all of those things. At the same time, I want to say, wait a minute. Okay, in our reaction against those things, let's not keep us from fulfilling our responsibility. And we need to think through this biblically. Now, we may not have a job that really, I teach biology, and so, you know, how do I go about my life? Does it affect how I go about my life? you know, am I now, since I've written the book, am I now leading the charge in some area? Well, as I say in the book, I'm not an activist. So I'm not the type to say, okay, let's get an organization going. Let's try to get a bunch of Christians. I don't want to guilt trip people into getting, that's what a lot of people do, is like guilt trip people into getting them to do certain things that they don't really want to do. And what I want to do as a biology teacher is not say, okay, everybody, we're going to adopt this bike trail and we're going to go out and pick up trash on the bike trail. Nothing wrong with that. But I would rather give them a deep appreciation and love of God's creation. It's antithetical to the activism mindset, because you're not telling them this is what you should do. You know, you need to go write your senator. I'm not a political animal. I want people to love God, love his creation. And that means that things start to be implemented at a grassroots level. Can you imagine as people start to love creation, and I mean in specific ways, they start to look at birds, they start to bird watch, they start to look at all the little critters, and they don't just see it as this sort of inanimate stage upon which I'm acting out my life, and they are all in, you know, too often we're just so centered on ourselves rather than centered on the glory of God and in his creation. And as you focus on those things, you start to appreciate that which he's made. And when you appreciate something, you start to value it. And when you value it, you start to conserve it. You start to take care of it. And so that's the progression I want to see. It's a grassroots progression, and it can happen at the individual level. It can happen at the church level. I'm not interested in starting this program. Gordon Wilson started this program. I just rather see the gospel start to change lives and change people's attitude toward nature. And when that happens, I would, you know, who's got the Audubon societies? Well, it's mostly secular people that do the Audubon societies. Why aren't Christians doing stuff like that?
Probably because it's, you know, it tends to be cast as stuff that's not kingdom work, or
right.
It's for the greens, and we don't need to mix in with those crazies.
Yeah, it's for the good. That's what they do. Yeah, and we don't necessarily have to, although I say it's not wrong to. If a particular society's mission isn't, if you don't feel like you're hitching a wagon to a pro-climate change alarmist, you know, group, that if you join them, you're somehow implicitly endorsing their political position. You know, I think a lot of these are sort of some of them are nonpartisan. It probably depends on the chapter. But also we could start our own, you know, if a particular chapter of an environmental group is just too liberal and you just can't be a part of that for just conscience reasons, then we need to start our own. But it is kingdom work. That's one thing we found about the Reformation, is that it doesn't have to be mission work to be ministry. Every calling that is under the lordship of Jesus Christ is Christian work. So you can be an entrepreneur, a Christian businessman. If you are seeking to glorify God in that, in everything that you do, in all of your business dealings and interactions, that is full-time Christian work. And if you are, whether it's an avocation or a vocation, there's nothing wrong with avocations, right? I mean, Christians do it. There's quilting clubs, and there's electric train clubs, and there's all sorts of crazy clubs. And we might think, well, that's not very, you know, I'm sort of leery of those too. But these are things that people can enjoy. And if we do them in a way that glorifies God, wow, that's great. And we need to do more of that rather than I don't want to get on a political power play. I'd like to see environmental policies be enacted by people who love God rather than having policies that are being from top down environmental regs that are being imposed on a chafing public that don't give a rip about this endangered species or that, whatever the issue is. They just love God, love His creation, and they want to live their life in a way that highlights that. And I think all sorts of things will start to change.
Yeah, it's interesting your emphasis there on just sort of grassroots development of biblically informed environmental policy. And honestly, I'm about as decentralist as you can get. I love decentralization of power and pushing things out locally as much as possible in just about every area of life. But to anticipate a question not from me, but from probably the average American or particularly someone who is in the green world, you know, how do you respond to the objection of, you know, if we just let this thing, you know, good policies bubble up naturally and wait for people to just quote unquote do the right thing instead of imposing something, it'll never get done. And then the environment is just going to keep getting worse and we're going to have to deal with more problems. And so we have to forcibly impose something on people in order to protect the creation. What would you say to that?
Well, it's clear from Romans 13 that there are people that are not believers. And even believers that don't fear God in certain ways. But it says in Romans 13 that the government is instituted by God, and we are to obey the government because it rewards those who do good and punishes that do evil. They do not bear the sword in vain. And so there are laws that need enforcing to keep people that don't really have a conscience in line. And so we do need laws. And I think certain basic laws that sort of, I think, grow out of a love your neighbor, when we think of things that really affect the environment, it's not just adverse, say, our activity at the corporate level can really do a lot of damage to the environment. And it's not like we have malice aforethought. It's not like these people that aren't very green are going out wringing their hands going, I'm going to destroy the environment. They don't think about the environment. They think about making a buck. They think about starting up an industry, starting up a business, and they want to maximize their profit margins and they see the environment or any environmental concerns is just a hurdle that will diminish. If they care about the environment, that's just going to set me back. It's going to reduce my profit margins. And we need to think in terms of, yes, we need to make a living, but we also need to love our neighbor. You say, but I thought it says love your neighbor, not the environment. But remember, the environment is what keeps us alive. And it's not just keeping us alive in terms of essentials like oxygen. And, you know, you could say, well, yeah, I just need oxygen to breathe and I need food to eat. And that means I need grass and I need cattle to eat the grass so I can eat my burgers. I need wheat to grow my bread and I need wheat for my beer. And we need, you know, we pick and choose those very minimalistic things that will keep us happy and alive, rather than say, no, God created a very diverse world with not things that just have utilitarian purpose, but things that enrich our lives. There are so many things out there that are not practical in terms of animals and plants. And we have to remember that God made those too. And it says God created all, saw that all He created, and He said it was very good. But we're much more pragmatic than that. We say, oh, I like this, this, and this, which is a tiny, tiny fraction of what He made. And we need to recalibrate our own desires, our own value system in light of what he said and say, wait a minute, life is more than just feeding your little, you know, feeding your face and keeping you employed. There's more to life than all of that. You do have to have these laws to keep us in check, but and so I'm fine with that, but I would, but the more you have people that just don't care, the more you're going to have to spend on law enforcement to keep people that don't care in check. And that's why I wanted to do it from a grassroots perspective. In the end of the book, I talk about the gospel as being the ultimate solution, because when you reconcile people to God, then as Francis Schaeffer says in his book called Pollution and the Death of Man, which I sort of springboard off of that quite a bit, is that the gospel heals all sorts of dislocations. The first and most important dislocation, it reconciles man to God. But there are all these other dislocations that have happened, man and our relationship with other men. So we're reconciled to God, then we can be reconciled to each other. And the gospel heals those things. But there's also dislocation between man and nature. We look at nature as just something that is a resource that we use, rather than thinking, okay, God gave it to us to use. We should just think more lavishly, like God has, and begin to appreciate those things that we often don't.
Yeah, well, you go out of your way a number of times over and over to kind of hammer on this point that, you know, we should value creation not simply for the utility that we get from it or from the beauty that we experience from parts of it, but that we should love and protect all of creation, even the scary or dangerous parts or ugly parts, because just because of the fact that God made them.
And I don't expect everybody to love everything, but just have to reorient themselves and say, okay, I might not, there are certain people that will never like what I like, and I understand that, but I want them to at least be open-minded to the fact that although maybe they don't appreciate it fully, and maybe will never appreciate it fully until the resurrection, they will at least say it's worthy of somebody's appreciation. May not be mine, but a lot of people just think only in relationship to themselves and say, well, I don't like it, therefore, if it goes extinct, who cares? Rather than, well, you know, no, somebody that's a brother or sister in Christ likes those things. They may not like them in a utilitarian way. It may not be some creature that they can make a buck on in some entrepreneurial pursuit. They just like it. There's all the things that I like, creepy crawly things. There's not a whole lot of entrepreneurial value in a lot of them other than a zoo. I mean, yeah, you can start a zoo. But generally, that's way beyond the single person. It has to be a much bigger corporate pursuit to have a zoo. But some people like those same animals in their natural setting, okay? Not just in a paddock at a zoo. And so we need to realize that as we develop, and I have no problem with development, we just need to be thinking in different categories, where let's develop in a way that is thinking circumspectly about the, you know, how can I minimize the damage and how can I restore what I damaged in the development process, or how can I minimize it during development? They're thinking in terms of beauty, truth, beauty, and goodness, not just how can I fill my coffers with money. And I think that's what's caused in the last couple centuries a lot of extinctions, is because we were just thinking in terms of maximum profit for me rather than thinking in a truly biblical dominion mandate sort of way.
I like one of the things you say in here is you say, once love for God is in our bones, effective methodologies of wise dominion will emerge sooner rather than later.
Right.
So I like that, but I've got a question to kind of test out that assertion. Do you think Christians have become more or less stewardship friendly in recent years?
Well, I think a lot of them are sort of confused and fall into various camps that we first talked about. Apathy to, you know, their eschatology may affect their view of it. I think they have been becoming more cognizant of the beauties of creation. I haven't taken a survey, but I know that a lot of Christians like to watch nature documentaries, and hopefully they'll start watching the one we did, The Riot and the Dance.
I want to talk about that later.
And so as we are exposed to a lot of the glories and complexities of creation, things that most people would never see if during their normal course of life, they would never see a lot of those things. Even if they hike, they will usually hike locally and they'll only see the same plants, same animals. But just being exposed to the wonderful cinematography that other people capture on film, and it brings it all into their own living room in high definition color. If they're Christians, even if the narration is secular and evolutionary, and it's all going to go up in smoke because of our awful climate change. And even with that narration, it's doing one thing, and that is having the Christian see the glory of their Father, even though it's handed to them by a secular. It's presented to them on a silver platter by a secular server, and yet they see it and go, God did that. And I think as Christians are exposed more and more to the glories of creation through that medium, they are becoming more conscious of it and more concerned about what we're doing to the environment. It's sort of ironic that I wrote the book because I'm so not political. you might think, oh, this guy's got to be a political junkie because he's going after a lot of hot button issues in politics these days. And I'm so not that. I really, really, like I said, really interested in a grassroots change, and it's afforded by the gospel.
Yeah. So let's talk about, since you brought up politics, let's talk about something that is political but really shouldn't be, which is this whole discussion about climate change and all of the activism that springs out from that really is not specifically grounded in actual science. You pose sort of three questions when it comes to evaluating that issue. You've got, is the planet really warming at all? If so, did humans cause it? And then if it is warming, is it necessarily bad? And in the current discourse, we really don't get beyond, one at all. It's assumed, and it's assumed that humans cause it as well. And there is no consideration given at all to whether there are upsides to this whole thing.
Right. That's true. And I'm not an expert. I'm not a climatologist. That's not my field. But I know enough about how agenda science works. I see parallels in the creation evolution controversy. As soon as there's an agenda of a particular scientific paradigm that is the consensus view, you either get on board or you're going to be marginalized or alienated in some way, shape, or form. And even without looking at the data, I am very squinty-eyed when I see that non-Christian climate scientists are saying, you know, I'm not convinced. You can't even talk about it as a Christian, non-Christian controversy. There are real honest climate scientists that just say, it's not that clear. It's a very, very, very complex subject. And climate models are fine for learning sort of interactions between various variables. They sort of teach. They're a good teaching tool, but they are not a good predictive tool at all. They're very bad at predicting. And you can look at trends, but those trends, again, are not slam dunk. There's even correlation isn't causation. But even the correlations between greenhouse gases and warming, even though you can prove in the lab that greenhouse gases will warm, there's so many other variables in a global scale situation that you cannot have models that are that complex and that predictive. And so it's really about peer pressure. And when I see good climate scientists completely blacklisted, they may lose their funding, they may lose their job because they're not pulling the party line. I begin to think something's up. This is not good science. Good science will invite discussion and conversation on both sides of the debate. But the way it's polarized, and it's like, no, anybody who denies climate change is a kook, a loony, and is going to be ushered out of the room. It's just bad science. So that makes me realize this is there's a lot of monkey business going on. But that said, there's, even if it is warming, there's all sorts of things that are good that can happen from it. It's not all doom and gloom. And yeah, there may be some factors that are negative for certain things, but positive for other things. And so we need to look at both sides of the issue and just approach the whole thing sanely without being reactionary cranks.
Yeah. And, you know, obviously I can't speak authoritatively about the science because I'm not a scientist. But what I can do is notice when somebody is pressuring me to just toe a line. And I immediately my hackles raise when anything like that happens. And, you know, as I've reflected on this, there are two sources that have really influenced the way that I think about these issues. One is Thomas Kuhn's The Structure of Scientific Revolutions, just having an understanding historically for how science has been done and how paradigms get erected and then eventually fall, but resist mightily before that finally happens, and just the way the examples of that throughout history. And then the other one, which is kind of funny, is a speech that I read in college by, of all people, Michael Crichton. And he was talking about how he recounted some interventions that I think the Park Service had done in either Yellowstone or Yosemite. I don't remember which. It was maybe trying to manage the wolf population, something like that. And every time they were doing something that they thought would be helpful, it backfired in completely unexpected ways. And then they'd have to go and do another intervention to fix that. And then that would backfire in unexpected ways. And they just could not get it right. And the assumptions that, you know, Crichton pulls out and explains why this was foolishness is that, you know, they were viewing the ecosystem and the environment in that park as a simple, a linear-based system. You know, A turns into B, turns into C, and you can trace it along and you can predict it and you know it's going to happen. And he said, it's not that way at all. It's a complex system. It's A times B might get you C tomorrow, but it might get you D or F the next day.
Yeah,
and so there's no way to predict what is going to happen. And there's no way to account for all the variables. And it's absolute foolishness and hubris to think that you can.
Yeah, in ecology, that's super hard. I would say climate's even harder because the climate is more complex than, say, even an ecosystem. I'm not sure about that. But it's there are certain things that they have done where they can't predict everything, but there are certain ways to manage. We are supposed to manage wildlife. That's what the Dominion mandate is. It's not just domesticated animals. It's the wild. And I think there are certain things that we can know. But I think, like you said, there can be too much hubris. You know, one system that seems to be the case is that we know that in subtidal zones in the Pacific Northwest, you've got sea otters that eat a lot of sea urchins. And so when back in the early 1900s, when the sea otters almost went extinct through fur trade, the sea urchin population exploded, and sea urchins like to eat kelp. And so it was one of those chain reactions where you get rid of the predator of sea urchins and they explode, and then they start to munch down and literally turn kelp forests into kelp barrens, where it's like a clear cut underwater. And so as they've restored the sea otter population, there are some variables. Yes, it's not cut and dry, and it's, like you said, A plus B will sometimes get you C, but not always. So there are complexities to the issue, or to the system. But it turns out that as we bring the sea otter back, the kelp forests have recovered, which they need to live because they tether themselves. And there are certain things that we can do. It's not all a crapshoot, you know.
Yeah.
So I agree with you that it's complex, but there are also things that we can learn about ecology that we can tweak this variable and say, hey, we don't know all of the complexities, but let's keep this animal, and it'll turn out that, hey, there's all these interactions that restore the ecosystem. So
yeah, I would say we need to pursue equilibrium, but with humility.
Yes, for sure. We don't know everything.
Yeah. Okay, so you have traveled the world and gotten some pretty fantastic nature footage. Tell me about The Riot and the Dance. It was originally based on the textbook you wrote, correct? And then you turned
it into
this
really,
film?
The textbook was just curricular, just a biology text. And when my nephew and best-selling author, N.D. Wilson, he was right next door to us, and a few years ago, 2015, somebody asked him to do a Christian nature documentary because he had already done a feature film, and he was asked to do this, and it was an investor, and he immediately came over to me and said, would you narrate? So I'd like to say it's similar to, I'm sort of Bilbo and Nate is Gandalf. I'm happy teaching my biology at New St. Andrews College in my shire, in my hobbit hole. But he had, he said, would you like to be a narrator? And I just thought, I've loved nature shows all my life. That would be just wonderful. But I'm not the type to make it happen. But he is. He's a shaker and mover. And so he asked, and I said, you bet. And so we started filming that summer of 2015 and went to the Sonoran Desert and went to the Oregon coast. And went to Sri Lanka and filmed there for 2 weeks and many different ecosystems there. And what we wanted to do is the subtitle of getting back to the title, my textbook was Riot in the Dance. Nate wanted to name it the same thing, even though it wasn't curricular. It was just enjoy. It was a cinematic celebration of creation. And it'd be a great, it's a great icing on the cake, you know, for class, if somebody says, but it was more for entertainment, family entertainment. But yeah, it can be a great augmentation to a biology class because everybody in a class likes movie day. So it's both biology, but they're sort of related in the sense that I'm involved in both and they have the same name. But other than that, and the meaning, I don't know if you were going to ask the meaning of the riot and the dance. Is that?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. The riot just refers to the fact that the world has fallen ever since man sinned. It brought death and decay. As it says in Romans, the whole creation is subjected to futility. The whole creation groans. So that's the riot. But at the same time, we see in Romans 1:20, God's invisible qualities, eternal power, and divine nature have been clearly seen, being understood from what has been made. In other words, God created, and a lot of the dance, the choreographed dance of nature, it shines through the riot. So even if you see a lot of riot and predator, prey relationships, parasite, host, all sorts of gnarly things that are ugly because of the fall, you can still see the glory and the complexity and the beauty of creation. So that's the dance part.
Yeah, well, I bought a TV for probably the first time in 15 years last weekend. And so we got a pretty good upgrade in screen size. And so I put it up on the wall. And the first thing that we streamed was Riot and the Dance with my 11-year-old. So we had a great time.
Well, that's great. That's great. That's great. I hope he enjoyed it.
Oh, yeah. He loved it.
Oh, good. Well, number two is coming out.
Yes. I was going to ask you about that. How many do you have planned?
Well, you know, Attenborough is still going and he's 92 or three, I forget. And I'm only 58. So if the Lord blesses this, we will continue a different, you know, it might, Riot and the Dance 1 and 2 sort of parallels Planet Earth and Blue Planet in the sense that one's terrestrial, one's aquatic. And I think we'll pursue other topics, whether it's, a particular area, a particular ecosystem, or a particular group of animals. You know,
yeah.
We'll see. We'll see how it goes. But I want to keep doing these things, especially if the Lord allows us to continue in this and we have the funds for it.
Well, the layer that is in place with Riot and the Dance that I really like that makes it in contrast to the secular versions is that you emphasize the morality and the philosophy underlying why it is that this world exists and why we appreciate it in the first place. Because you watch Planet Earth and Blue Planet and all that stuff, and you know you get a lot of the wonder and the majesty, but you're kind of left there out hanging with, you know, to quote an Andrew Peterson song, "Don't you want to thank someone?"
Yeah, exactly. But there's no one to thank. They'll say, "Isn't this great?" And it's so great that we need to conserve it, and we are ruining it because of climate change and blah blah blah. But really, it's all an accident. So
yeah.
if it came into being as an accident, that means there's no purpose. There's no purpose giver. You know, only God can be the creator of it all and the one that makes it meaningful and purposeful. And we can just be filled with gratitude towards him and for his making of all of this wonderful diversity. For them, they just have to say, it's great. Isn't evolution amazing? And as I've said in a number of places, that's blasphemy. When you take God's masterpieces of art in terms of plant and animal life, those are masterpieces of design and glory. And then you're basically saying, no, given enough time, matter, energy, it can happen through these mechanistic processes. Talk about an insult. Talk about sacrilegious. I mean, if you look at the definition of blasphemy, that pretty much fits. It may be inadvertent, but it's blasphemy all the same. So I take it as we need to do these because these secular ones are going to keep doing it. And what we need to do is outdo them. Right now, we've got a lot less of a budget, but we've got the right story. We've got the truth. And we hope that God will bless us richly so that we can, I think our story, our narrative is true, but we want to surpass them in the beauty and goodness department in terms of cinematographic excellence. And we'll let people decide that, but we want to get there. I mean, we've got a budget that's not anywhere near close to theirs, but we don't want that to be our excuse. We want to keep on fine-tuning it, and hopefully the Lord will bless that.
Well said. Well, the documentary is The Riot and the Dance. The book is A Different Shade of Green, A Biblical Approach to Environmentalism and Dominion Mandate. I think it is, you basically can fit with any person within the realm of Christianity. This book has a point and a message too. You don't have to be into science. You don't have to be into nature. If you're a believer, then there's value here in this book for understanding how we're supposed to engage with the environment and with the world, and how the creation leads us to worship and how that prompts us to treat the world around us, and lots of practical tips in there as well. So,
yeah, do you think this book would be like, say, a church and a book study or a Sunday school? Because I do have some discussion questions. Do you think it would fit that format?
I do. Yeah, it definitely would. It's not a difficult read from an academic perspective, but it certainly is beefy in terms of laying out pastoral and biblical principles for understanding the world that we're in. So, yeah, I certainly would see the value with that. Really appreciate your time. And I'll link to the book, to the documentary streaming on Amazon right now. That's how I watched it. All of that will be on the show notes page. And any final comments or closing words?
Well, thank you very much, Seth. God bless.
Well, that'll do it for episode 12. Thanks again to Dr. Wilson for coming on. The book is A Different Shade of Green, and the documentary is The Riot and the Dance that is now currently streaming on Amazon. And I really encourage you to check that out as well as the book. And with that, go forth and read widely. Just maybe you will think a little differently about the world around you as you go through your day. See you next time.